Hi, everyone. This is Kyler from Feeding Matters. Coming to you on August 22nd is the 2025 Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. This year, we're going deeper. We're hearing from more professionals. In fact, we're going to hear from all four domains of PFD, as well as the two domains from ARFID. And we're going to look across lifespans, starting with neonatology and going all the way to adulthood. Most importantly, we're highlighting the lived experience. So if you want to come together with other professionals who are engaged and dedicated to serving families and children who struggle to eat while hearing from those families directly, this is your opportunity. We'll see you on August 22nd.
Presented by Feeding Matters with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Feeding Does Matter. My name is Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
Hi, I'm Haley Estrom, and I'm an associate professor in the School of Nursing at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. How are you doing today, Jacqueline?
I'm doing well, Haley. I have really loved getting to know all of our speakers, and today we have two speakers that I don't know well, so I'm really excited to have this time with them to be able to learn more about their journeys and their work and get a little hint of what they're going to be bringing to us on August 22nd and on demand afterwards for the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. So we have with us Dr. Olivia Shin and Dr. Ayala Bental, and they are speaking at the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. Their session is Reduction in Feeding Problems Following a 12-Week Interdisciplinary Group Feeding Intervention. And so Dr. Shin, Dr. Bental, so great to have you today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, these sessions are so great to be able to just get to know you and know your journeys a little bit better. And so I know there's two of you, and everybody comes to these professions and this career and specialty in a different way. And so I would love to just learn a little bit more about how that happened for both of you. So maybe Dr. Olivia Shin, let's start with you, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. So as you mentioned, Dr. Olivia Shin, I am currently an assistant professor at University of Southern California, Keck School of Medicine, and Children's Hospital of Los Angeles. And my specialty area is in pediatric psychology for children who have both medical conditions and developmental disabilities. And I came to feeding twice, I would say. I think the first time around in training, it was trained in much more of a traditional kind of very behavior chart based, following a kid under the table, you know, remembering, you know, that first time you get the broccoli. There was something about it that for me personally, like we all just have really different personalities and different styles. And for me, I decided to take a break from feeding. And really where I fell in love with feeding again was at Rady Children's Hospital, where I was before I am now. And the way and the style and the philosophy of it just really felt like such a match for sort of who I am as a therapist and how I think about families and parent-child relationships. And so that was sort of that love kind of emerging from feeding really came from my time at Rady. And right now, I'm at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. I'm an interdisciplinary feeding team there. It has a very similar type of philosophy where we're really focusing on parent-children interactions. And when you think about kids who, you know, have feeding challenges, and in a U.S. mainstream-based culture, when parents or caregivers are asked to feed their children 3 times a day for meals, 2 times a day for snacks, 5 times a day, this parent is getting rejected and getting negative messages all the time about how they are and how they can't nurture their children, or even, you know, starting at infancy or the kids who are in the NICU. And feeding is just challenging from the get-go and how it impacts parents. It's something that became just really just a love of mine in terms of working with these children and families and being able to make a dent in their lives. And they've really impacted me as well. And as a parent whose child actually ended up having early feeding challenges too, you know, from like day two, like I do feeding in and out, and these some of the doctors really made me feel like absolutely terrible. Right. And it was just really interesting being on the other side too, really, really kind of really underlining just how important this work can potentially be for some families.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing, Olivia. Dr. Ayala Bental, how did you find your way to feeding?
Well, my background was in more developmental disabilities. I went to graduate school at UC Santa Barbara and more focused on research with and treatment with autism. Then I was an intern at Kennedy Krieger Institute and worked on the feeding unit there and learned. That was my first introduction to feeding anything, because before that, I didn't know anything about it. And that was a long time ago, many, many a year ago. And it was a very, you know, specific approach to eating and feeding, which has been published about quite a bit. Then I did a 2-year postdoctoral fellowship at Brown, focusing on developmental disabilities and autism as well, both outpatient, inpatient. There wasn't a feeding program, but there were many of the patients I had eating issues, whether they had developmental disabilities or autism. It just was a very common issue among the patients. And since I had some experience with feeding, I started working with some of those families. I asked to work with them, and they somehow ended up on my caseload as a postdoctoral fellow. And so continued my interest in the area of feeding. And then I became a psychologist here at Rady Children's Hospital. I've been here for 25 years, so a very long time. And I joined the feeding team since I had interest in that. They already had an established feeding team. It was sort of new. It was in its infancy, but it had already been established. And they had been trained by Kay Toomey and doing the SOS approach, and they have had other types of approaches that they used, and they had started running these groups. And so I'd been part of the feeding team since then, and we've been running these groups clinically for a long time. And I help run the parent education component, and I've also worked with the children as well. So I've just continued this interest over all this time.
Wonderful. Thank you. In your view, and so maybe we'll keep with Dr. Bental, what do you feel like are the emerging trends, or what do you think is in for this field in the next like 3 to 5 years? And what makes you excited about that? Or is there any like concern that you have about what that 3 to 5 years out looks like?
I think, we've been using a multidisciplinary approach. I feel like in the hospital setting, we have that opportunity to do that. And I'm not sure if that's as common in just regular clinical outpatient work. I feel like there's occupational therapists that work on that, and then there's mental health specialists that work on that. But I feel that it is truly unique for us to work in a multidisciplinary group where we're all working together in the same space. There's just something very powerful about that. And I'm not sure everyone has access to it. So I think that's what excites me, is that multidisciplinary, because I feel like I've learned so much from working with OTs and speech therapists and the dietitians. I've just learned so much and absorbed so much from them that I think that's what really excites me. And I hope that we can continue to offer that, with changes in healthcare and all of that. I just hope it's not very cost effective, I guess, to have so many people working with one child or a small group of children. So the other, trend that I'm interested in is telehealth. I feel like maybe over half of our work has been over telehealth since COVID. And we've continued that despite, being able to go back in person. And I feel like it does reach some folks that traditionally maybe wouldn't have come in because they're just out there, they're rural, or they just have a lot of barriers to coming in. And additionally, with feeding, we get to see them in their natural environment. We get to see them at their dining room table and with their family and all the other chaos that might be going on in the home versus just in this like sterile clinical environment where we're just isolating it. So I'm wondering about the potential of, you know, the telehealth and how that might change, you know, the field.
Yeah. Dr. Shin, any responses? I saw you nodding a lot.
I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, being on an interdisciplinary team is really just magical in terms of all the different lenses and be able to work together to really create, like, how do we best support a family and what aligns with that family's values and their traditions, rather than this doctor told me to do this and that doctor told me to do that and this person told me to do that and I don't know who I'm supposed to listen to and how to put it all together anymore. So I think that was probably the enthusiastic nodding of just loving just the co-treatment providers and all of my colleagues in speech, in occupational therapy, in nutrition, and the pediatricians and everyone else. I also never thought I would love telehealth for feeding, especially. And I have just been absolutely amazed. It was maybe like week two, week three into that transition in 2020, where I was just really blown away by how much more information I was getting in treatment sessions, right? And how, and now looking at it for the last 4 or 5 years, I don't have the data. I would love to go back. But to me, it feels like I'm getting far fewer, concerns expressed by parents. Like, they only do it with you on Tuesday afternoons at 3, or they only do it in the clinic. And the minute we go home, you know, everything the same, you know, and these are parents who are just absolutely, you could videotape them. They could run a course for other parents. They're doing everything you would suggest in clinic. You know, what's that missing piece? And I feel like I'm not seeing as much of that gap anymore now that we're on telehealth, where now that we have the real table, the real stressors, multiple siblings at the table, the I'm trying to take this phone call while I'm doing this, like, you start realizing what are some of those differences in real time of why there might have been previously that gap between what happens in clinic and what happens at home. And I feel like the suggestions and recommendations can also be a little bit more realistic when you're outside that really sterile, everything is perfect in clinic where there's nothing else going on and just the parent and just the child, where I think that real life, those colors and those textures of what's actually happening.
You're getting the ecological validity.
Absolutely. And I,
whole situation.
It almost feels like treatment has been faster and progress has been faster. In my mind, again, I don't have the data, so don't quote me if you said. But it does feel like I'm able, just the speed at which families are really doing things in real time. And okay, this doesn't quite work for this situation. Maybe this family only has 2 chairs and there are 4 people at the table. You know, like, we're able to really just brainstorm much more in real time and really adjust it. So,
yeah.
Also,
Any other trends that you're thinking about?
Yeah.
Not any trends, but I think my hope would be that there are just more options for more people. Like where I am now, I've done a lot of lecturing for other providers in the county where, you know, maybe like Dr. Pintel was saying, that not everybody has access to a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary team. And so then, like, sort of training other people to be able to do that work, because I think there's so much already on social media. Parents are just getting such mixed advice and so many different messages of, you should do this. No, you should absolutely not do this. If you don't do this, your child will have challenges for the rest of their life. There's just so much out there. And so I think the more that we're able to spread for, you know, some children absolutely need that multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary approach. But also there are other folks who could use sort of a lower level of intervention and care. And so if we're able to reach people earlier and more people feel competent and excited about feeding, because, I mean, it's food and it should be fun, then I guess that would be more of a hope than a trend per se, but it would be my hope. When we have a mental health crisis and long wait lists, that really we can reach more people.
Yeah, for sure. Dr. Bentel, any responses to that? I also saw you nodding too. You guys are very in line.
Yes, very much so. Libby and I worked together a long time, so we agree on a lot of things. But yes, I also agree with her on just, it's hard sometimes to find people who have this specialty. So I love that Olivia goes out to do outreach and train others, because often, you know, there really isn't anyone to be needed to refer out. There's just a lack of therapists, and especially in the mental health area, I feel. You don't really meet too many folks in the mental health field that have training in this.
And just a plug for my colleagues, and usually the trainings include either speech language or occupational therapy or nutrition. So I'm not training alone. So.
Right. Doesn't work in a silo. That's one of the taglines for the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit, is that PFD and RFID aren't siloed. So why should we work in silos? So that's why multidisciplinary care works, no matter what your team looks like.
Exactly. Well, I mean, with all the emphatic nodding that our listeners cannot see, we are seeing a lot of passion and hearing a lot of passion for these topics. Can you tell us why you chose the topic for your presentation and why you're passionate about it? And let's start with Dr. Shin.
I think for us, it's that we think treatment works, right? And that there's just different, I mean, just like we've got so many different types of psychology treatments out there, that the same could be said for feeding. And so we think what we do and permutations, I think there are slight differences between hospitals, but what we do works, right? And so we just wanted to look at the data and see if the data back up what we think is happening as psychologists. And so, yeah, it was a retrospective review looking at decades of research or decades of clinical data. Are we just feeling good about ourselves and thinking, you know, that, oh, yes, we think we did a good job, let's pat ourselves on the back? Or, like, can we actually look at the data and, you know, is it supporting what we think we're doing? Because at the end of the day, we want families to get better.
Yeah. Dr. Bentel, do you have?
Yeah. And I'm much more of a clinician first, and I'm not much, you know, since grad school and postdoctoral fellowship, I haven't really done a ton of research and mostly focusing on the clinical work. Mm-hmm. And I think this was really interesting because this is something we're already doing. We're already providing this service. It's, you know, we have a variety of different patients. It's a large hospital with lots of insurances, lots of different diagnoses. This is like real life. You know, this is what we actually are providing. And, you know, we wanted to see if, in fact, this is effective. This is actually working. And I think that's helpful because we're not just in this sort of isolated clinical research world where everything is so perfectly adjusted for and controlled for. I mean, yes, there's Absolutely. A lot to say for controlled research. I agree. But there's also something to say for like this messy, you know, this is what we do just clinically. And
yes,
is it effective? And I think that's really helpful to have this kind of research, not from like, I'm not, you know, 100% researcher, but I, you know, we're doing this work and we want to know if it's helpful. And I think for the typical clinician, that might be nice to relate to this kind of program.
Completely agree. I think there's a huge need for clinicians to be sharing. And I think that other clinicians will definitely appreciate hearing about this work. I wish that more clinicians would find the time or be able to, you know, share their information and their data and, you know, what they've accomplished, because we know that people are. And so I'm very grateful that you all are sharing this work. This is fantastic. So glad that you are.
Yeah. We feel lucky that our program was supportive.
I mean, yes.
Our coordinator, who also will be there for the summit, our name is Haven Qualman, and she helped coordinate all of this. And very supportive, just generally, of clinicians and of research. And I think it's important to have people in administration who support this kind of work rather than just, we need you to see as many patients for as much as possible. You know, that's important too, of course, but there's also that support for, you know, the program development, is this effective and all of that. So it's
nice. And really the backing that you have from administration to do that. Because we know that even if we're asking for more research to be out there in this field or all of those things, there's still so many barriers, like having administrative support or having the time and space to be able to look at that. And so it's so wonderful that you have someone on board in looking at it in that way.
Yeah. We have a research arm of the hospital that was helping create some of the adjust some of the measures for us. We had a statistician as well who, you know, it's not part of our department, but was brought in to support. So I don't think we couldn't have done it without that. So it was very appreciative.
Yeah. Haven Qualman is just amazing at really just the level of energy she has and really just gathering people together. I mean, it was just really impressive.
What would you say is one core question your session will answer? And why is that core question so critical to be answered? We start with Dr. Bental this time.
If I think about sort of the core question is this sort of clinical work effective or not? I feel like that's the core question that we're trying to answer. And that, as Dr. Shin mentioned earlier, there's different approaches to feeding. And this is sort of a widely used approach because there's training for it. And you know, both Kay Toomey does training and Marsha Dunn Klein does training for these kinds of approaches. And the information is out there and clinicians are using them, but it hasn't, there's fewer research, I guess, published papers and other articles about this type of approach. And so I think that's sort of the core question that we're trying to answer.
That's great. Jushin, do you have anything to add?
No, that was great.
Wonderful.
And I think what's exciting, too, is, I mean, for those of us who really want to do more research in the future, is it's not a feasibility study yet, right? This was just more real-world data where we were looking at it. But it, at least if someone is trying to apply for a grant or wanting to get funding and support, since it is hard to get that kind of support to do research these days, that at least there is some, you know, the beginnings of something that someone could quote and cite to maybe try and get some of that funding to do the research. Because as we know, most hospitals these days are kind of tight financially and having that they want people to get funding and grants. And so having something to talk about or cite could be hopefully helpful for other clinicians and researchers out there.
The evidence ladder needs to start somewhere, right? You need to have it. It's great. What's one idea you'll explore in your presentation that you think might flip the way people think about the topic? And why do you think that is?
Honest, I don't think what we have is like breakthrough. People are going to have these opinions.
Is there an idea that you think might change the way somebody might think about something?
I feel that the cognitive and emotional components that contribute to feeding issues, both we look both child and parent perspectives, whereas a lot of research, you know, published ones anyway, focus on the behavior. We're focusing more on the emotional and cognitive aspects. And I think that might be a little different and may change what some people think about feeding treatment.
Yeah. I mean, my hope would be for folks who maybe not, who don't do this approach, and for them, like another approach like operant conditioning really speaks to them, that maybe they'll consider, why is this child being non-compliant, so to speak? You know, what emotion might they be feeling? So if we could have folks at least consider that piece of it, that would be exciting. And how the parent feels or caregiver feels in all of this.
Which discipline, expected or unexpected, do you think will find this talk most interesting? Dr. Bental?
Well, I would hope that all the disciplines, any clinician that works with young children and feeding would be interested.
I think that's almost a trick question.
Yeah. I think psychologists, other mental health, OT, yeah, speech, dietitians, you know, pediatricians, other health practitioners. Olivia had did you have a thought about some other potential?
I don't know if folks, who listens to the podcast, but I think in some of my work, some of the most meaningful or people who I've unexpectedly found get really excited with what we're doing in feeding have been teachers. The teachers of the clients that we see, they're like, especially since we have universal lunch for folks, right? It's like, I wouldn't have given it to that child because I knew they wouldn't eat it. Whereas, like, once we kind of walk them through, they're like, they, like, touched it in school. You know, like, sometimes you get that piece because I don't think it's part of their typical training. But that's one place that's been an exciting partnership. Since kids are in school every single day, it's a beautiful, yes, naturalistic exposure opportunity. It's a social opportunity with other kids. And so sort of like giving a few extra tools, I think that's maybe the less obvious audience members than our usual colleagues that we're working with at the hospital.
Yeah, I don't think mainstream education or education, like special education settings, are really given much for kids with feeding problems, kids with feeding disorders, at all, beyond like if they have tube feeding. So,
I really love that as an answer.
Really good.
And I think it's so timely with back to school season happening right now too, that a lot of families are having those conversations with their teachers and maybe are facing a teacher that doesn't know or hasn't experienced, you know, any sort of background information on what to do to support that family and what that looks like. So I love that answer.
And when we've done interviews with families of children with feeding disorder, it's a huge mental load of work that they have to take on every year.
Yeah.
And working with the school system.
Mm-hmm. Especially for kids who already have other diagnoses. It's sort of like, what do you pick and choose when you're introducing your child? You want them to have a great first impression of the teacher and not give them this whole litany of like, there might be the IEP, but we really want the teacher to see the child for who they are as a person. And so how do you pick and choose? And so
the balance of what do you share? How much do you share? On any preconceived notions heading into the school year.
Feeding and eating is something that they work on an IEP. It's not usually a goal. As you said, if there's a feeding tube, then this nurse has to, you know, incorporate that. But if it's just other eating issues like selectivity, or they don't usually address that in the school setting. So
they do need to be supported to eat in the way that they eat best in order to access their education.
Yeah,
their brains need food.
They do. And so that's just a great outreach opportunity for what we have to do as we raise awareness and provide this education and outreach. So thank you for bringing that to the forefront, Olivia. Ayala, you have a fun lore of what's happened in clinic and maybe during this study or maybe just in general, a clinic story that became a legend story. So would you love to share any behind the fun scenes of this session? That was our question, but you said you had a good story to tell and I want to hear it.
Yes, I have a funny story. This is data that's been collected over many years, both with a child's group and a parent group. And this one day during the children's session, I was there helping with a warm-up activity. It was making pudding, which is having the children place milk and pudding mixture in a bag, and they're supposed to shake it gently. And these sort of cooking activities, mixing, helps the child get acclimated to the food in a fun way. It's this fun exposure. And then maybe later we do something with it, like, you know, touch it or do other things. But in this situation, the children were shaking the bags. And one child who was just overly enthusiastic I was sitting right next to him, decided to mix it really well by slamming the bag very hard against the table. And what happened was the bag just burst completely. And since I was the closest to him, I was covered from head to toe with this sort of milky clumps of, you know, milk and pudding mix all together. And it was just all over me and probably half the room. So that's just a very funny experience that happened as part of collecting data for this group.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you get like little pudding cups or pudding references now?
Yes, I do.
You're just the pudding therapist.
Like the pudding, it's just become such a lore, such the, you know, part of the lore feeding team is the pudding incident, as we say.
I'm sure all the therapists have all their like messy versions of that. Like they can share messy stories because, and I think you said this before we started like recording, you got to get messy sometimes.
Food is messy and you have to embrace the messiness of the food. It's part of the exposure.
Yeah.
Maybe I wouldn't want that much exposure. Head to toe would be a little much, but
yeah.
Well, that's a great one. Thank you so much for sharing. And now you'll just have that many more people knowing about your story.
Yeah. My cheeks hurt from laughing.
Yeah, Olivia. No, that's me too.
From like laughing so hard from your story. I've talked.
Oh goodness.
No, I love it.
If it were in person talk, people would bring you pudding cups.
Yeah. I do think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speaking of the summit, though, what are some sessions that either of you are looking forward to?
I did see that Marcia Dunn Klein is providing a micro keynote, and I'm looking forward to that. I also noticed that there are lived experience presentations, like both like at the end and beginning end. And I always love those because I feel like I learn a lot from parents' perspectives.
Yeah, that's been the comment a lot of people have shared is the lived experience, and that's why they're there. We really want to combine what's in the research, what's happening in clinic, and what's happening for the lived experience as well, and how can we merge that human story. And
those are my favorite conferences, is when you get both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're both looking forward to that, and I really appreciate your time and getting to know both of you. We started this podcast to really be about that lived experience.
Yeah.
And so one question as we close out that I have for both of you is what are some barriers you've talked about? Like, I think your research is a great example of research that maybe there is a gap that we're just starting on that ladder that Haley referenced. And that's something that the Patient and Family Centered Research Consortium of Feeding Matters is really interested in looking at.
Okay.
And so the question that we always ask our podcast guests is, what do you think are the barriers to lived experience, patient and family centeredness in research? And what do you think are maybe potential solutions? And I will say it's intentionally big and vague.
Yeah.
We know it's a lot to tackle, so answer it however you want. But maybe we'll start with Dr. Shin.
I think finances and resources. I believe really strongly that people should be compensated for their time and their energy. And these are families, often the ones that I see where I am now. I'm not the only provider, right? PT is telling them to do XYZ during the week. OT says you need to work on ABC. Maybe they have an ABA provider who's also there in the home 3 times a week, and somebody else is telling them to do something else. So to ask families to help us expand the research, and there may be other siblings with other needs in the home, I think being able in some way to not just sincerely recognize the what it takes to share your experience, but also being able to provide some kind of compensation of some sort, even if it's not as much as we wish we could give. I think that's huge. But, and I found this in other areas of research I've done, it's also hard to get the grants that can then help fund, you know, whether it's those gift cards or other things that we provide for. And then I think the other piece is just trust, right? Like a lot of folks may have gotten a lot of negative messages in their life. Like, you know, you're the first person to say, like, where I'm not being blamed, right? Where the parents say. And so the idea of sort of, if I'm sharing my story with other people, you know, how are other people going to judge me if most of the other people have been, well, if you only just starved your child, if you only just did X, Y, Z.
All the advice.
Right. There's a practical piece of the finances and the time commitment, but I think also trust and trusting the research community to do justice for folks.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah. That's all I'll say.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great answer. Any responses, Dr. Bantal, or any of your own ideas for barriers and solutions?
I agree with Olivia. And I, you know, our program, like you said, it's a clinical program. It's still running. It's, and we don't really ask the parents to do much more than what, like, we're providing the service to them, and we already have them fill out questionnaire. If you just kind of insert it into you're already working, you're already seeing the family, and, you know, you want them to do some, you know, pre-work questionnaires and some data and need some post. If we could get more time and support to just use that, I think we would learn a lot, because I feel like there's a big disconnect between sort of clinical and research realms. And if we want to get research that's more real, it's more day-to-day what actually happens, we need to do it in our clinical world, and not to ask too much more already of what the parents need to do and what the clinicians need to do if they're mostly clinicians. And provide them that time and support. And I think we'll learn a lot. Sort of my thought about it.
Yeah. I love all of that. And I feel like it really wraps up what you all have been sharing today, not only in your journeys and how you found yourself in feeding, but also the work that you do together, and then the work for this presentation and session as well. And this research that you've done is, it's really looking at, like, how can we be based in reality as we research and really filling a need with where there is a gap, and then also kind of bring in that conversation of what are we doing individually, and how can we help support the individuals that are showing ourselves in front of us. So I feel like it all beautifully ties together, and I just am really glad to have you today. So thanks for coming in. For those of you that are listening, we hope to see you August 22nd for the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. It is also available on demand at the few months after. So we will see you then, and that's when you can see Dr. Shin and Dr. Bantal give their presentation. Olivia and Ayala, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hi, everyone.